This is the Rebel Author Podcast, where we talk about books, business, and occasionally bad words. Hello, Rebels, and welcome to episode 242 of the Rebel Author Podcast. Today, I'm talking to Cindy Dees, and we're talking all about tropes. But first to the comments on Bianca's episode. So Chris said, loved it this episode. Her enthusiasm was contagious and I'm intrigued by posting visuals, furniture, clothes and asking for names to her readers while drafting the book. I may try that with my next one. P.S. Also loved hearing you get so excited about Regency queer history. If you geeked out over the Molly houses, wait till I tell you all about the drag balls held in Harlem, New York from 1869 until the 1930s. See, historicals aren't so bad. Okay, Chris, you in? I would like to know more about that. In personal news and updates, I think I am going to keep this week very brief. I am now in the process of writing my annual lessons learned, and I feel like anything I say now is going to be a repeat of that. So I don't want to say too much other than I am very tired. What a fucking surprise. And I am trying to recognize what everybody keeps telling me, which is that I'm really hard on myself and perhaps I might need a bit more of a break. I'm in a little bit of a transition because I'm reducing the amount of things I have on my plate so that I can focus on more words, but that also reduces the pressure. One of the reasons I write so much is because there's so much to do, I can't fuck about and I have to just get the words done. But also I'm really tired and I need some of the, in air quotes, fuck about time to, I don't know, rest. I'm just struggling a little bit with structure and how I do living. As an author now. Anyway, now that I have said no to so many things and I kind of reduce my time so that I can focus on the things that I want, you would think it would be as easy as just focusing on the things you want to do. That would make sense, wouldn't it? Yeah. Anyway, I am halfway through book two and charging towards the finish line. I moved my days around this week so today I'm actually recording this early. It's Tuesday the 7th of May. Normally I would record tomorrow, but I was super tired today, didn't sleep very well, so I decided to move things around, which apparently is something I find very hard to do. I'm very rigid. That's what she said. Anyway, so I've moved everything around doing admin today, which means I'll have like 3 solid days to go at the wording I also wrote yesterday, even though it was bank holiday. I know it's terrible, isn't it? Anyway, moving swiftly onwards. The rebel of the week this week is Rosie. Rosie says, my now ex and I adopted a gorgeous dog, Hugo, a number of years ago, but we disagreed about whether Hugo would be allowed inside the house while we were out. I said that he should be allowed inside the house and that we should install a dog door so that he could come and go freely. My ex insisted that Hugo stay outside while we weren't at home. Hugo is a husky mix, and for the next several months, anytime we left the house, he would jump the fence and try and find us. He is a rescue, so he is rather an anxious wee boy. Naturally, I was very worried about this, but my ex just kept making the fence to our place higher and higher. Eventually, he installed a camera and saw Hugo easily jumping the now over 2 meter tall fence, balancing carefully on the thin plank of wood at the top and gently jumping down to be on his way. I had to chuckle at how easily Hugo kept foiling my ex's plans. Things came to a head one day when we were out late and we came home to find that Hugo had scratched up the front door, obviously trying to get in. After that, my ex finally installed a dog door and Hugo never once ran away. And Hugo never once ran away again. I'd have been such a smug bitch at that point. Oh, I fought hard to keep Hugo in the to keep Hugo in the separation, and you'll be pleased to know that not only does he now have a dog door and a bed both inside and out, but clever boy that he is, he has even worked out how to open the door to my room. Holy crap. Also, I love this story. I love the pet rebellion so much, but also I love that you were right. Oh dear. Well, if you would like to be a Rebel of the Week, please do send in your story. We are always running low. It can be any kind of rebellion, something big, something small, or even something pet-like. You can email your story to Becca over on rebelauthorpodcast@gmail.com. Welcome and a huge thank you to Gigi Rivers, and of course a giant thank you to all of the show's existing patrons. I have just in the process of sending out an update on all of the dates. We've got Poison and Prose sessions and classes. I'm pretty sure I'm going to run, so we've got a guest lecturer, I'm going to say, for this next class. Then there will be news and updates about the ones after that as we get to them. So this next class is on middle grade fiction, and you can also get access to the Slack community where we all chit-chat and hang out and help us support each other. So if you would like to get early access to all of the episodes as well as bonus content, like I just mentioned, then you can from as little as $2 a month by visiting patreon.com/SashaBlack. This particular episode is sponsored by Fictionary. So one of the things that you guys may or may not know, depending on how long you've listened to this episode, is that I used to be an editor. I used to do developmental editing. And I am also the world's first ever Fictionary certified story coach, which means I'm a certified developmental editor. I don't do developmental editing anymore, but I was once upon a time a developmental editor. And I can also say that their developmental editing course is incredibly thorough. You have to do a full developmental edit as part of it, but you get to use their software. You get taught about all of the different story editing elements, and it is basically fantastic. You get time in sessions, you get loads of support and the community as well. It's also one of, to my knowledge, the only certifications out there that really focuses on story plot, characters, structure, and setting. The other awesome thing about the certification is that it is a community, and Fictionary writers themselves will often end up commissioning and hiring story coach editors to edit their manuscripts. And as you are a wonderful Rebel listener, all of the listeners of this show get 25% off Storyteller and Storyteller Premium and Certification with code REBEL25, and that is in all caps, REBEL25. Now from me this week, let's get on with the episode. Hello and welcome to the Rebel Author Podcast. Today I'm joined by Cindy Dees. Cindy is a New York Times and USA Today best-selling author of over 100 books. Cindy has sold over 2 million books worldwide. She writes in a variety of genres, including thrillers, military adventure, romantic suspense, romance, fantasy, and alternate history. Cindy is also the creator and executive producer of an upcoming Netflix television series based on her Helen Warrick thriller novel about a series about a woman assassin, which sounds totally up my street. A former US Air Force pilot and part-time spy, she draws upon real-life experience to fuel her stories of life and sometimes love on the edge of danger. And I will leave all of her social links in the show notes. But hello and welcome.
Thanks so much. I'm so happy to be here.
No, I'm happy to have you. I'm dying to ask about the Air Force and the spying.
That's always the first thing people want to know.
Of course. were you an operative, or like how does it work? You tell me?
I can. So I was a pilot, and I also was a Russian and East European studies major in college. And so that means I speak Russian. And when I showed up in my first squadron to fly in Washington, D.C., a gentleman there introduced himself, and he had a very Russian name. And he said, "I heard that we had a young pilot coming in who speaks Russian." And I went, "Well, that would be correct." And he took off in Russian, and I had to speak back to him. And he said, "Have I got a deal for you?" And diplomatic flights from when I started, it was the USSR, and then it ultimately became Russia. When they come into or out of US airspace, we put escort pilots on the planes with them. And vice versa, it's a tit for tat thing. They demand Russian pilots on American diplomatic flights in and out of their airspace. And so they had never had a woman in the program. And so I got some training and I had to memorize a bunch of aviation vocabulary in Russian, which they didn't teach me at uni. And I just flew along on these flights. What we discovered very quickly was if I acted dumb enough and blonde enough, and I am a blonde, they would tell me all sorts of things they shouldn't because they wanted to impress me, but didn't think I would understand. And so it was the sum total of my spying was going into cockpits of airplanes and looking around going, oh, there's so many dials and switches. I could never remember what all these do. Oh my God, what does that one do over there? And they would go, well, this is our new identification friend or foe system, Cindy, and this is how it works. And I'm like, no, well, what does that button do? And you know what that one does? And they would tell me.
Oh my God. I mean, patriarchy and just like, oh, inherent sexism. And oh my goodness me, I can't even. But wow. What
yeah,
a
I got you to appreciate
career.
That one.
Yeah, I really yeah. did. Like, yeah. You can tell a power woman from like when you're a power woman, right? And I'm just like, inside, I'm dying.
Well, and I have to tell you, I can't go into the details of this, but I was in a situation a couple of years ago with a friend, and some security was involved, and we needed to not acknowledge that the security was there. And so we were going about our day, and the event ended, and she and her team went elsewhere. And she called me the next day and she said, so my team had a message for you. They could not believe how dumb and how uncomprehending you were able to act when you would look straight at them. They were shocked. And I went, aha. And so I have to say my dumb blonde act has served me in good stead.
You should have been in Hollywood. Perhaps it's helping you with your Netflix stuff now.
Indeed.
Oh, yeah. That is amazing. And I know Netflix is super tight-lipped. When is it coming out? Like, when will it be on the...
That's an outstanding question.
Oh, okay.
So the average time for a movie to go from purchase to produce to actually in theaters is 7 years.
Wow.
And so we're about 3 years into this project, but the pandemic was going and the writer's strike happened in Hollywood. So it has been delayed longer than it should have been. And I'm very low on the totem pole of information. I'm the lowly writer. I get no information from anybody. And so occasionally somebody will send me a text or they'll ask for some information. So my impression is that it is gearing up to start work. And so things will have to happen, like scripts will have to be written. The director is already attached. Interestingly, the very last thing that will happen is the actors will be cast for the parts. Mm. That happens right before filming starts because it depends on their availability. And so actors commit and then want to jump right into the product. They don't want to wait and say, oh, sure, I'll do that, and then have it not film for 2 years because they don't know what they'll be doing in 2 years. Mm. So we are starting into the pipeline. I'm hoping within the next year, it'll actually be on television. But I couldn't tell you. I don't know much about the timeline once they get rolling.
That is literally so exciting, though. It's like
it's
the
very
dream,
exciting.
Right? Like,
yeah. Yeah, it's super exciting.
Amazing. When you've been through the process, I'd love to have you back on so that you can talk about kind of, you know, the experience and what you learn and all of that stuff. But...
Oh, I've already learned a whole lot. Like, I know that everybody's a liar in Hollywood and don't believe anything anyone says. And holy cow, if you think writing contracts are bad, you should see Hollywood contracts. I had one contract come to me that was 7 pages of minuscule print that was nothing but threats of what would happen to me if I busted a non-disclosure agreement. Because everybody, I mean, the money is so big. And I am a firm believer that large money brings out the mean in people and the dishonest in people. And the so people just don't behave themselves well in general because there's so much money involved. And all of the contracts are designed. And my daughter's a lawyer, and she described it as they're fencing the velociraptors from Jurassic Park with these contracts, that they expect them to try to break out. They expect them to try to break contract clauses. And every clause is written with the expectation that somebody's going to attempt to breach it at some point. And in my experience so far, that is correct. I have had multiple attempts at breaches of my contracts already, and we haven't even started production.
Wow.
It's very ugly.
Yeah, that I feel like we, so normally I start by saying tell everyone how you got to where you are. I feel like we sort of done a part whistle stop of that. But how does one go from a US Air Force pilot spy to writing romance novels and thrillers? Like, that is quite the career change. Don't you miss flying?
No, I don't miss flying at all. It was my job. It was hard. It was exhausting. And again, the flying itself, I really enjoyed. But I ended my Air Force career with the flying in the first Gulf War. And we outflew the pace of the bomber pilots in World War II by about 15% for a year and a half. We were exhausted by the end of that. And I was ready to get out of the cockpit for a while. So how you go from being an Air Force pilot to an author is your mother is an English teacher and a writing professor specifically. And she bets you a dollar you can't write a book. And
oh my God, stop. Do you know your Clifton strengths? Because you...
I do.
Oh my God, do you have competition?
Yes, number four.
It's my number one.
Gotcha. Yeah,
I heard it. I knew as soon as you said that, I was like, she has to have competition.
Oh yeah. Ideation, strategic activator, competition, and focus.
I love it.
It's a pretty evil combination. Yeah. So I was flying home from pilot training to visit my family for Thanksgiving, and I read a book on the airplane. It was a spy novel, and he's dead now, so I'll say his name. It was a Clive Cussler book, and I think he was a wonderful author, by the way, but he also wrote very prolifically, and some of his books were stronger than others. And I got off the plane, and I flung this paperback at my mom, and I said, even I could write a better book than that. I knew everything that was going to happen from page 10. And she went, oh, yeah. And I went, I could. And she went, I dare you. And I went, I could. And she went, I bet you a buck. And that's how it started. And on my office, I won't get it for you today, but I have my mother took a $1 bill and my very first published book and put them in a shadow box. And they hang next to my desk.
She paid up. But what an amazing mother to know that their daughter is competitive and to encourage her in that way. That is absolutely magnificent. Like, I love
she's
that
an
so
evil
much.
Genius. I come by it honestly.
Oh my goodness me. No, I love it. Okay, well, you have written a plethora of books, but we're going to talk about your nonfiction or some of it. I don't know if you've written other nonfiction, but your nonfiction for writers today, which is based on tropes. And I've got your books and I love them, and they've already helped me this week to fix something in my plot. So I'm super grateful. But first of all, let's talk about tropes, because writers fling these words around, readers use them to talk about what they're after. And quite often I think that people only half know what a trope is rather than really knowing what a trope is. So let's start with the basics. What is a trope and why do we even care about them?
Okay. So there are two definitions for a trope, and this is where the confusion comes from. If you open up the Oxford English Dictionary and look at the entry for a trope, it's going to say it's a cliche and it's an overused literary device. That's a formal definition. In the publishing industry and in the literary world, we mean something completely different. So a trope, for the purposes of writers and publishers and editors, is a classic story arc that is recognizable and predictable. And they've probably been getting written since the beginning of time. So if I were to say to you, Romeo and Juliet story, you know immediately what that's going to be. It's going to be a young couple who fall in love, they overcome obstacles, they're eventually caught, and they die tragically. If I say it's a Cinderella story, we know exactly what that means. We know what the beginning, the middle, the black moment, and the ending are going to be without you having to say anything more. And so those are tropes, classic story arcs that we all are familiar with. And they're really important, and we'll probably talk about those more, about why they're important for connecting with readers as well. But they're stories that we know going in what's going to happen, and those are tropes.
So I split. So I feel like they're it. So you've obviously mentioned the two different definitions. I feel like in the writing world, there are two types of tropes that people talk about and get confused with. I have coined it just because I find it easier, major and minor tropes. And by major tropes are what you've just said, those tropes with innate story structure and stakes embedded within them. But then there's like the minor slash micro tropes that can be things that are people recognize, like, but that wouldn't necessarily have innate story structure, like only one bed, for example,
Or a
right? Like,
Highlander story, or yeah.
yeah, or masquerade ball. That's not a trope, but it happens often enough, particularly in fantasy, that it could, when you use it in your marketing, it appeals to readers. So I feel
Yes.
like that. Do you have a definition for those kinds of things?
I tend to call those story elements.
Okay.
And again, the language doesn't matter. If you want to call them a minor trope, that's absolutely fine. But yes, there are certainly repeating story elements that we're going to see: cowboys in stories, Highlanders in stories. And you can even break it down by genre. If you were to look at fantasy romance, again, dragons are going to be pretty typical. Elvish races will be typical. Magic is going to
Hey.
be typical. Fae are going to be typical. Sure. Castles, questing, and those don't tell you what's going to happen in the story, but they are certainly elements that are classic and that you would definitely want to signal to your readers, because they're beloved by certain readers, and you want them to find them and come to them.
Yeah, I feel like the trope in the major sense is like the Christmas tree, and the minor ones are like the little baubles that we put on the
Yes.
outside.
Yes, I describe the major tropes as the skeleton of all stories.
Love it.
And then there are the decorations, and that's an excellent analogy. And I've recently heard a couple of publishers say, "Oh, I'm so sick of tropes in books. I just wish people would just write a book without tropes." And I'm like,
What? Okay, but that's a
"How?"
right. So that's a really
And
good
so,
question,
right.
because why should writers pay attention to tropes? I definitely tried to write something super original with the very first book I ever wrote and learned my mistake very quickly. Because it then becomes completely impossible to market because you don't really know what the story is. So I guess there's two questions in this. Why do you think tropes are such good reader hooking tools? And like, what is it about them that works? And like, why then is it so important that writers do start with the tropes or do use tropes in their writing?
In reality, there's no such thing as a book without a trope, because the trope is the beginning, the middle, the black moment, and the ending that are your story. They are the basic structure of your story. And I don't know if you've ever read a book called Waiting for Godot. It's two men sitting on a, it's Samuel Beckett wrote it. It's a play. It's a horrifying thing. Don't do it if you don't like just existential nothing. It's two men sitting on a park bench waiting for this guy named Godot to arrive, and he never arrives, and they continue sitting on the park bench. That's the play. And that is the only story that I know of that really doesn't have a beginning, a middle, a black moment, or an ending. And it's not a literary favorite of people. So there's Lisa Cron. I'm going to quote her as the expert on this. She wrote a book called Wired for Story, and she talks about why humans crave stories. And she does it much better than I can, so I won't go into it in any great detail, other than to say neurologically, we learn from stories. We learn how to avoid the saber-toothed tiger without having to experience the saber-toothed tiger ourselves. And so humans see learning from stories as safety. And hence, it is something that we've been hardwired to do since the beginning of human communication. And so, you know, from a neurological standpoint, readers crave stories because they want to experience them vicariously without having to go through everything the characters go through. Or they do want to vicariously experience the happy endings that the characters get. So certainly there's that appeal. Where tropes become incredibly important for readers is there are certain story types we all love, and there are certain story types we all hate. And it could be that we have a traumatic experience in our past that makes us hate a particular trope. It may be that we have a particular point of view or an opinion or a belief that makes a trope unappealing to us, and vice versa. There are tropes that call to each one of us individually. And when you're writing a book, I would suggest that the books that writers really, really struggle with and hate passionately by the time they're done with them are probably when they're writing books that are tropes that don't call to them. And so I wrote category romance for Harlequin for a long time. And there were times when they would tell me, we need you to write a book about, and they would give me the story, the trope. And I didn't always like those tropes. And some of those books about killed me to try to get through. And this is where I really started having to study tropes and understand them, was to just survive books that I didn't like. But it's a good bet that there are readers out there who have experienced packaging on a book that suggests, oh, it's going to be a fluffy, fizzy champagne Regency romance read. And they open it up and it's a rape saga, and there's a dent in their wall from where they threw it across the room because it one trope was promised and another one was delivered that they disliked intensely. And that's a really great way to tick off readers very quickly. And so, you're going to write the same tropes over and over. If you look at all the books you've written, there are going to be tropes that repeat themselves.
Yep, I can
And
already
readers.
tell you that. I do it on purpose because I love
And
writing
so,
it so much.
since you spoke of, so Becca Syme has been doing some research about how readers read, how they come to the reading process. And again, I'll let her speak for her own research, but the gist of it is, the longer readers read, the more they niche down in the story types they like best. And for the long term, most readers will have a handful of tropes that they love that they go back to over and over and over, over many years. And once they have found what they love, they're not going to vary much from reading that. So again, it's really about what you love as a story type.
What's your trope? Is your trope for reading the same as the trope for writing?
Sometimes there are some tropes that I will read that I don't feel comfortable writing just because I either don't feel like I have enough experience with it or I don't have enough knowledge of it to get it right. But yeah, I mean, I tend to write women, strong women in jeopardy, and strong men who stand by them and help them, but don't rescue them outright, that they rescue each other.
Okay.
That certainly repeats over and over in my stories. I've been told, I was really shocked. It's surprising too, tropes will creep into your stories unconsciously. I had a reader walk up to me probably 7, 8 years into my career. I had about 20 books out. And she just walked up to me and she said, I'm so sorry about the difficult relationship you have with your father. And I was like, excuse me, what? And she was like, are you aware of how many of your books, your heroines have very distant or estranged relationships from their father in? And I just stood there and stared at her in complete shock. And she was absolutely right. I'd been writing it in as just a very minor theme in my books for years without even realizing it.
Holy
And
shit.
indeed, my parents had a horrifically bloody divorce. And in my mid-20s, my father left my life. And I had no idea that I was writing it out. And so sometimes the stories that have made up our own lives are creeping into those books. And The great Mary Jo Putney once told me that the first books you write are easy because you're writing about the superficial tropes of your life, and that the longer you write, the more you dig for the deeper and harder tropes of your life, the more it becomes like just choosing a vein and opening it to bleed on the page to write. Yes. Whoo, is she right?
I really was very resistant to that truth, and for a really long time. And it took my strengths coach pointing out how I was not, I don't want to say therapizing, but like, how I was writing down either things that I had learned, like about me or about life or about people, and I just could not believe it. And I funny enough, one the first book I ever wrote, my I had a friend who was a teacher, and it was a young adult book, and she let her class deconstruct it, and she asked the class, "What do you think this author is like?" And I shat the bed because it was so accurate, and this was teenagers, and I was like, "How dare you?" No,
Right.
all of these things are wrong. But one of the things that I tend to do is I have really interesting sibling dynamics in almost all of my books. And the reason for it is that I am one of five, but all on my father's side, I'm the eldest, and there's 20 years between me and the youngest. And one is a stepsister who I get on with the best. And then, like, they're a very, it's like a blended dynamic and is very difficult, very complex. I don't know if you've ever seen Succession. Have you ever watched
I have. Yeah.
Succession?
Oh, yes.
I have never felt more seen in my entire life. So I told you, so I'm a number one competition, right? My dad is also number one competition.
Oh, no.
All of my siblings have competition in their top five. It is
Oof.
a vicious, ruthless family. And Succession, like, just I am, and we're watching it now, and I just sit there like this the whole time because I'm like, this is so real. This is exactly like my family. And anyway, so the point is, I totally agree, and I do think that we explore these elements in our fiction without us even realizing it. There was one thing that you said about talking, I think it was about the Lisa Kron stuff, and you were talking about how tropes, how people, humans like to learn things and experience things th safely through story. So do you feel like there is an innate lesson unique to each trope?
Oh, absolutely. A hundred
Oh,
percent. A hundred
okay.
percent. Now, in the large scale, in the romance world, every romance novel's trope, the message is love conquers, fill in the blank. In the mystery world, the answer is justice conquers, fill in the blank. In the thriller or like the military world, it's the good guys conquer, fill in the blank. And so that in its very simplest is the message of, each genre of books has a generalized message. But then when you narrow down to an individual trope, it's going to give that message in a different way. Love conquers fill in the blank by solving fill in the blank. And so there certainly is an overall theme. But so like I saw you had the you picked up the backstory trope book that I just recently released. And that's all about traumas, that trauma is preventing somebody from falling in love because fill in the blank, fill in the blank trauma is preventing love because fill in the blank. And that book about killed me to write just because of the amount of research I had to do on so many different types of trauma. And while I commented earlier that readers may avoid a book because it has a trauma in the trope that they don't like, readers will also go to books to deal with traumas that they've experienced and to see a happy outcome from a trauma that they have lived or been adjacent to. And so it's a two-edged sword. People may avoid it, but they may also go toward it. Books are also a way to live out taboo fantasies. Where you don't pay the price for experiencing the fantasy. And so, again, I think in the backstory book, I'm surprised you haven't already jumped on me about my comments about ethics in that book. I'm not telling people they cannot write taboo stories. I'm just saying if you're going to write something that has the potential to trigger or harm people, you need to think about the ethics of how you present the story, in a way that, doesn't give false and damaging information, harmful information to somebody. And so again, even though we're talking about romance novels, as an author, I felt like it was really important to ask writers to think about, what are you telling your audience? What story are you telling your audience? What information are you giving your audience? Is it factual? If it's not factual, are you telling them somewhere in the book, you know, up front or in an author's note, this is not factual, you know, here are resources to go get facts. Because readers will learn so much from a fiction novel and take away so much information that we need to be aware of that.
So that kind of feels like a great segue into my next question, which was about mistakes. Like, mm-hmm. Aside from, I guess, either misrepresenting or not giving trigger warnings or things like this, are there any mistakes that you see writers making when like trying to approach working with tropes or just trying to write a trope?
So introducing a trope, introducing a story element that promises a full story and then not delivering the rest of the trope, I see quite a bit. I saw a manuscript not too long ago where in about the third scene of the book, the main character, who was a police informant, witnessed a transaction where somebody was selling a biological poison, like a chemical weapon, to somebody else, and then it never showed up again in the rest of the book. And, you know, you're promising an entire story based around, there's a chemical weapon floating around in this book, and we need to find it, and we need to lose it, and we need to be on the verge of it being released, or it needs to be released, and then we need to solve it. That's the trope of that chemical weapon being introduced, is, you know, struggle to find it, oopsies, it gets released or almost released, oh, we caught it, all is well. And I see authors, young authors, do that a lot. They'll introduce many tropes in the beginning of a book and then not follow them through.
Bit and, like Chekhov's. It's a bit of a Chekhov fuck-up, really, isn't it? Yeah.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And I think that's the number one thing I see. And it is possible to put many tropes in a single book. I took a look at Twilight because it's a book a lot of people have known. And off the top of my head, I identified 29 tropes in that book. And if you go deeper in the Twilight series, there's another dozen just very right off the top of my head. And there are probably more if I dug deeper. If you look at Rebecca Yarros's Fourth Wing book, again, I just off the top of my head found about 25 tropes.
Yeah,
just on a first read through. So it is possible to do a lot of tropes in a book, but anytime you introduce one, you then need to follow it all the way through. You need to give its middle, its black moment, and its ending for the reader.
So let's talk about that. How can you layer tropes up?
So some tropes sit side by side very easily. You have a lone wolf who has moved into a small town to make a new start. Those are two different tropes, having a fresh start in a new town and a lone wolf who's going to be tamed. They go together hand in hand, and they almost seamlessly blend with each other. What I generally do is, if I'm going to put, say, three or four tropes in a book, is I will, and I should probably admit first, I am a plotter first, as opposed to a pantser writer. So as a plotter, I do it before I start writing. I will write down the beginning, and they're called obligatory scenes, by the way. That's their fancy formal literary name, is obligatory scenes, is I'll write down the beginning scene for each of the tropes I want to use, the middle for each of the tropes I want to use, the black moment for each of the tropes, and then the ending for each of the tropes. So now I've got, say, let's say we're going to do four tropes. I've got 16 scenes laid out. I will then look at those scenes and ask myself, are there any ways I can combine two of those into a single event or a single series of scenes? And almost without exception, you can mix and match elements of multiple tropes in a single scene, a single big argument, a single major event in your story. And so, trust me, Twilight and Fourth Wing don't have 29 times four scenes in them. What they've done is they've used scenes to do multiple things for different tropes at the same time. If I'm pantsing a book and I want to go back and see if I've gotten it right, I will take my draft, which a friend of mine recently called a 350-page outline. But I will take my draft and then I will go back and I will just look at the list. I'll make a list for myself of the obligatory scenes and say, is it in there? Or have I missed a scene that I should have put in? And I will then go looking for the things that I've left out of the tropes that I thought I was writing about. And I will confess that when I was early in my writing career, I used to tell people I didn't know what my book was about until I finished it, that I would write the whole book and then sit back and go, huh, what is that about? What is the theme of that book? What is the message of that book? And that would then tell me what trope I was supposed to be writing, which I might or might have not have gotten right. But then I would go back and revise it based on, okay, I actually turned out I was doing this. Do I have my obligatory scenes for that particular trope?
So you talked a little bit there about Fourth Wing and Twilight and the fact that you went through them. One of the things that my competition loves doing is to go and look at what's selling in the market, look at what's done well, and then go, okay, how did they do it? So I will deconstruct books. I've even written a book about deconstructing books. How do you do it? How do you find tropes? What would you say to new readers who need to go and understand their genre and the tropes in those genres? Like, how can they spot them? How can they take out information from the books that they're reading?
Well, if you know what a trope is, anytime you read a book, you can look for what is the beginning? How did they set up the big story element? What happened in the middle of the story that complicated that story element? How did it all go wrong? And oh gosh, I'm on the edge of my seat going, oh no, there's only a quarter inch of book left. How's she going to solve this? That's your black moments. And then how did it get solved? And so, I mean, it's that simple. Every book has them. And unless, you know, it's Waiting for Godot or Chekhov left one out. But in general, every book is going to have that beginning, that complications of the middle, the disastrous moment of all is lost. And then we're going to fix it and it'll turn out okay. And so you can start analyzing that. I always tell readers, take a hard look. What are your favorite books? And what are the things about them that make them your favorite books? And I guarantee you, you're going to find repeating tropes over and over. There are story types that you gravitate to.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. So what can we do to make the, for want of a better word, make the tropes more tropey? How do we make them resonate more? Like, how do we really land that trope well? Mm-hmm. One of the things that I tend to, so I get away with it, and I'm not really sure why I'm getting away with it, but my favorite trope without exception is enemies to lovers, no question.
Uh-huh. Yes.
But what I typically end up doing, which a lot of, so, and my audience is really split. Half of them say I write enemies to lovers, and the other half are like, you write enemies and lovers, not enemies to lovers. So, mm-hmm. And I think the reason they say this is because they often bang very early on in the book, but it's because mm-hmm. I write very spicy. Sure. So I always establish, and also this is the other thing. So with enemies to lovers, there's two ways to do it. I always find either they are historically enemies, and they come to the story, they already know each other, they already have a history, or they become enemies on the page. I am mm-hmm. incapable of writing enemies on the page. Why? Because it takes them longer to get to the bang scene. And I just can't do it. I just cannot do it. So they have to start enemies already. And every single book I've written, that's, and I would love to be able to write a true, like, enemies to lovers, they become enemies on the page. But at the moment, I just don't wanna.
Well, for what it's worth, that's one of my favorite tropes as well. That's a repeating one for me as well. So what was your question? I got so interested in your enemies to lovers. And I'm like, Sorry. Who doesn't love some good hate sex? But
I know, right? Oh my God, it's my favorite. Right. Okay, so my question was, how do we make them more tropey? How do we make the tropes tropey?
So I tried an exercise in my books, and I think I did it badly, but I wanted to just put the idea in writers' heads to think about it, is I ask myself, what is it about this trope that readers will love? And what if I loved, and by the way, I don't like every trope in the books and I had to really fake it hard on some of them, but if I love this trope, what are the elements about it that just make me just go, oh, I love this so much. This just makes me happy. And so, like, for the enemies to lovers, I love a good witty comeback, a good snarky, you know, oh, snappy. Oh, yes. You know, I'd have never thought about that. Oh, burned. That's awesome. So that's certainly an element of the enemies to lovers trope that everybody's going to adore, is the really, you know, nasty banter that, and again, not mean, but just that quippy, snarky banter. The friction of a passion, because I always say that hate and love are, if it's a circle, they're at, you know, 1259 and 1201, that they're side by side, that hate and love, that passion, is very exciting. And so the passion, and it doesn't surprise me that you have them having sex super early, because passion is passion and it explodes in whatever way it explodes. And that's delightful. But then there's also elements you can get a little deeper psychologically of, is there somebody in this person's life who drives them crazy in a negative way? And a positive way to deal with them is to say, what would it be like if all of that, you know, anger and irritation I have toward a coworker, or toward a roommate, or toward a friend were to become this other thing? You know, could I find the thing in them that is lovable? Could I find the thing in them that's redeemable? Or I know I irritate the crap out of somebody. What do I have to do to make that person find the good thing in me? And so I do these game mental exercises with myself of what is it that the reader is going to love about that trope? And another way that I think is good to find those elements is to read people who do that trope very, very well and sell a kajillion books in that trope, or who, you know, everybody on TikTok is raving about that book, which has that particular trope. Take a look at it and see what are the elements that as you read it, you go, oh, yeah. Oh, I love that. Oh, she hit that just right. Oh, that's just the way it ought to be. That's a really good way to help identify the elements within that trope that make, you know, make it a really well-delivered trope. Yeah. But I think it's about hitting the reader's fantasies and hitting the reader's, the things they love about that trope or that they want from that trope. And, you know, isn't that what we as writers should be doing? What does my reader want? Let me give that to them. And so I don't know that many readers stop and think about what does my reader want out of this before they start writing a book or when they're revising a book.
That's how I start now, is what does the market want? Not even the reader. Right. I ask, mm-hmm. what does the market want? Because, and this is something that I'm trying to learn with my strengths coach. So I'm yellow dominant. I have 5 yellow strengths in my top 10, and which is a gift and a curse, as they always are. Much as I influence, I can be influenced. Mm. And when I write a book, I have to switch off listening, because readers start screaming, you know, where's the next book? Where's the next book? Oh, I think this happens. I think that happens. And then I stop being able to write the book that I should be writing. Right. anyway, so you have 2 other books. Well, you have more than that, I think. I can't remember how many books I've got of yours. I've got all of them anyway. But 2 other books that you have are about internal and external traits. Mm-hmm. What's the difference? Why do we need to pay attention to them? How can they help us write better stories?
So when I decided to write a book about tropes, I expected to, you know, have maybe a page or two on each trope, and that I could put all of the romance tropes I had identified in a single book. And it might be 400 pages long. You know, that was what I expected. A nice single title length book about, you know, identifying and describing tropes. Oh, bless your heart. Right? And so then I started writing about them. And the first couple of write-ups I did were pretty ignorant. And I hadn't started adding in some of the other lists. Like, I hadn't started thinking about adjacent tropes that are similar, but not quite the same. And I hadn't decided to put in the list of, you know, what are some reasons why readers love this trope? I hadn't decided to put in the list of books and movies that exemplify that trope. And so the write-ups were 3 or 4 pages. And I thought, well, you know, it'll be a long book, but you know, I'll probably do an ebook anyways, and it'll be fine if it's 600 pages. And then the trope write-ups started getting longer and longer. And I'm writing these 6 and 10 and 12 page write-ups for each trope. I had a lot to say about each trope. And then I started doing the lists of things to think about when you write about the trope, and lists of the traps that you can get into when you're working with a trope. And before I knew it, I was writing about 10 print book pages on each trope. It was about 16 manuscript pages on each trope. And then I started doing the math of, I've got something like 400 romance tropes. This thing's going to be 1700 pages long. I have to find a way to break it up. And so I am the first to admit that breaking them into internal, external, backstory, and hook tropes is purely an exercise in finding a way to divide up my gigantic list of universal tropes into manageable chunks. And I tried a bunch of different ways to split them up. You know, I even thought about just do the dumb things alphabetically. And then I finally was like, nope, this I think works the best. So internal tropes are problems inside yourself, issues you personally, emotionally have inside yourself that prevent you from achieving happily ever after in love. The external romance tropes are factors outside of you that are interfering with you falling in love. So example, your families are feuding with each other. The two main characters in the story are fine, but the people around you are now interfering with you falling in love. The backstory tropes is trauma from your past. What about your past, events in your past, is stopping you from falling in love? And then the hook tropes is the, honestly, I could have probably called it the meet cute hook tropes, but it's how did you meet in a way that then suggests an entire story? For example, an arranged marriage. That is a way two people might meet that suggests how the story is going to progress going forward. That was the setup and how they were thrown together. And so it's a mechanical device for splitting up a gigantic list of universal tropes. And I should probably stop and say the universal tropes are tropes that apply to any genre of romance and any romantic relationship in any other genre of fiction. So you could be writing a noir mystery novel, but have, you know, two characters in your story having a developing romance, and you could grab one of my tropes out of a trope book and use it to describe their developing relationship. And then I have three more volumes coming that are genre specific tropes that, you know, only apply, like, so for example, like a mail order bride, that's really primarily a historical trope. While it has been done in modern day, it's atypical. So that would go in the historical tropes.
I can't believe that we've been chatting for as long as we have. So I'm going to have to ask one last question before I ask the ultimate podcast question.
Oh, no.
What do you wish writers would do more of when working with tropes?
I wish they would write from the heart.
Oh.
I wish they would go to the tropes that either are their places of greatest joy or greatest pain or greatest learning, or you know, greatest romance in their lives. That I think all of us, when we tell the stories that are truest to us and most meaningful to us, those are the books that really resonate.
So what you're saying is bleed onto the page so that everybody can work out that you have an estranged relationship with your father or your siblings or your,
It's a vulnerable place to be, but the books of your heart are the ones that sing to readers.
Yeah, I really agree with that, unfortunately. It's a horrible truth. Okay, well, this is the Rebel Author Podcast. So tell everyone about a time you unleashed your inner rebel.
As a writer or just as a human being?
As a human being.
Oh gosh. My whole life. So I was the first and only woman pilot in every squadron I ever flew in.
Wow.
And 'cause I'm that old. I was in the fifth year of women pilots in the US Air Force. And so nobody knew what to do with me. And I flew a large airplane called a C-5. It's a cargo airplane that's larger than a 747, if that gives you a scale. It's gigantic. We drive tanks on and off of it. It'll carry two tanks at a time. And when I became an aircraft commander, there had never been a woman aircraft commander in my squadron, and nobody knew how I should behave. And so when you're training to be an aircraft commander, they send you out with an instructor pilot who's going to act like a dumb co-pilot. And you pretend to be the aircraft commander and he pretends to be your dumb co-pilot. But then if you get into trouble and you're over your head, he's there to bail you out and tell you what to do. And so my first instructor that I flew with said, "So I want you to think in terms of being the mom on your crew, herding 15 guys around Europe on a summer vacation. And so, maybe like bake brownies for them. Maybe like when they're getting into the hotel, help them check into their rooms. Find out where they're going to be going to drink and, make sure you've got a phone number so that if they need somebody to like come guide them back to the hotel, because it turns out drunks get lost in foreign cities, you can go fetch them. Maybe make sure they're all in bed." And I was like, okay. I didn't bake brownies, by the way. I was like, I draw the line at brownies. Thank you. And it was just very awkward and uncomfortable for me. The next instructor pilot, as I'm trying to June Cleaver my crew around, goes, "Cindy, Cindy, Cindy, no. I want you to be more like a man. I want you to make your voices sound deeper on the radio. I want you to be gruffer. I want you to swear. I want you to talk about like golf and the stock market," because that's a lot of the guys talked about golf and the stock market at that time. But think like a guy. So on that trip, our first crew rest was in Geneva, Switzerland, whereupon I went out and found at the Swiss Army knife store a pink Swiss Army knife, because you have to carry a Swiss Army knife in your flight suit. So I got a pink Swiss Army knife. I found a pink mechanical pen and pencil set. I bought a pink t-shirt with a kind of a high neck. So when I had the collar of my flight suit unzipped a little bit, you could see the pink t-shirt, which by the way was out of regulations. I put my hair down in crew rest. He told me to leave my hair up. I had hair long enough to braid. It was about the length it is now, and I would French braid it when I was flying. He said, "Leave your hair up." And I was made sure to have my hair down. I went to a hair salon, got it styled nicely. And I got a teddy bear, a pink teddy bear. And I put the pink teddy bear right in the top of my helmet bag, which would sit beside me while I was flying. So I went full pink on this guy because I was so offended at being told to act like a man. The next time I flew, I was with the chief check pilot in the wing. And he was just going to be an instructor pilot. And he came in and he said, "Okay, so how are you going to brief up the crew for this trip?" And I looked this guy in the eye and I said, "I am not acting like a man. I am not baking brownies for my crew. I will wear pink and crew rest. And if you don't like it, I'll just stay a co-pilot the rest of my career." And he leaned back and he said, "Yep, now you're ready to be an aircraft commander."
That is amazing. Oh my goodness me. I absolutely love that so much. The fact that you've got to like embrace you for who you are, and that's when you are ready. Like, and isn't that the moral of the story with writing as well, right? When we embrace our inner self, those are the books that tend to land the best. Oh my goodness me. I'm so sad that our conversation has come to an end. I've absolutely loved talking to you. Would you like to tell everyone where they can find out more about you and your books and anything else that you would like to add?
Sure. So my website is cindydees.com, and I imagine you'll put that in the comments. And then I write clean and wholesome romance under the name CynthiaDees.com, which is my palate cleanser from blowing things up and killing people. And so those are both out there. And then all of my books are wide on all of the major platforms, and in ebook, and some of them are available in print. And then, of course, the nonfictions are out in print and ebook on all the major platforms.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much for your time today. And of course, a giant thank you to all of the show's listeners and all of the show's patrons. If you would like to get early access to all of the episodes, you can do so by visiting patreon.com/SashaBlack. I'm Sasha Black. You were listening to Cindy Dees, and this was the Rebel Author Podcast. Week, I'm talking to Stephanie Chandler all about how to write and launch a nonfiction book. So join me next week for that. Don't forget to tune in and subscribe on your podcatcher. And when you have a moment, please leave a review.